Yeah.
We will open the Senate Committee on Rules for April 7th, 2009. I'm going to open a public hearing on SJR 31. And if the committee administrator would give a brief overview after she has time to sit down and...
Yes. Senate Joint Resolution 31 proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution to provide that a proposed initiative may not be substantially similar to a proposed initiative that was rejected at an election within the last 5 years.
Okay. I believe the only one I have signed up at this point is the Secretary of State. Madam Secretary, would you please come forward, identify yourself, and... You didn't actually mark if you were neutral, in favor, or opposed to the bill, but...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, Kate Brown, Oregon Secretary of State. I think in my testimony it will become very clear. We really appreciate you hearing this proposal. As I travel around the state, I hear from Oregonians about their frustrations with our initiative system. They are extremely concerned about fraud and abuse in the signature gathering process, and I'm addressing that issue with the introduction and hopefully the passage of House Bill 2005. Hopefully it'll be coming to your Senate committee in a few weeks. Oregonians are also extremely frustrated by time and time again being asked to vote on the same initiatives they rejected in prior election cycles. Last fall, we voted on Measure 59 involving deductions of federal taxes from our state income taxes. It failed. Voters had also defeated it twice before. And ballot measure 64, union dues, also defeated, had been voted on and defeated three times before that. This dynamic undermines voter confidence and makes people think that their votes don't mean anything. SJR 31 addresses that issue. It's based on a Wyoming statute calling for timeout for 5 years from the date of the initiation of the petition. This proposal would, in effect, require an initiative that failed in 2008 to sit out two election cycles before it could be placed on the ballot in 2014. Although you could start to gather signatures during the 2012 election cycle. And I would certainly welcome a discussion about this timeline. In addition, we will be asking for an amendment for this proposal for the Attorney General to decide whether a measure is substantially similar or not. If voters adopt SJR 31, Oregonians will still be able to access their initiative system, and we can alleviate voter frustration and fatigue. Thank you for your interest and your time, and I'm certainly happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions for the Secretary of State? Senator Atkins.
Thank you. Madam Secretary, if a citizens group runs an initiative, the initiative doesn't pass, but it's close, let's say, and then the legislature decides to have a referral in response to that, and it goes out, and it fails, Do under this bill would the original grassroots group that wanted to run an initiative have to wait?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, my recollection from the language would be that it would the citizen initiative would have to wait the time period from the time of their initiative. I don't believe that the referral would count in that time frame, but that's a really good question. I'll have to go back and take a look at the language.
Thank you.
And your name tags are mixed up. That's Senator Burdick. You don't care?
Okay.
Well, one of them
Senator
is
Burdick
often confused.
And Senator Atkinson are confused?
No, one of them is often confused. They're voting more alike. That proves my
Mr.
point.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if that should make me feel good or make me not feel good.
Okay. Additional questions for Secretary of State.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many times was women's suffrage voted on in Oregon?
That's a great question. Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, I believe that was voted on three times before it became law, 8 years before the National Amendment, the 19th Amendment, was passed, giving women the right to vote.
Mr. Chairman, I think I remember then-Senator Ben Westland reminding everybody that women's suffrage was voted on at least six times.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, I could be wrong about my numbers, but I use that. That's what I said. It was voted on three times before it was finally passed the fourth time.
Okay, so that would have made a 20-year gap between initiatives, 20 years, if we had a five-year waiting period.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, I thought about that particular instance in crafting this particular measure, and I think there are a couple of things how I would respond to that. One is the system has really changed over the years, and it has no longer the citizen-driven grassroots process that we like to think of as Oregon's initiative system. This is really a system that's driven by financial interests. And Oregon, of the 24 states that have some form of direct democracy, Oregon has the least form of regulation over the initiative process. What results in that, I think, is a lot of special interest spending lots of money here in Oregon repeatedly. I think that's very different than sort of the citizen-driven process that was envisioned when the initiative system was passed. What I would say about giving women the right to vote is that it took a period of whatever, 8 years or whatever the time frame was, four election cycles for there to be a passage of women's suffrage. I'm not sure whether it was the passage of time or asking the voters to repeatedly give women the right to vote that made the difference. And I would probably make the argument that the education level and that voters' opinions changed over time, and that's what led to its passage, as opposed to the fact that voters actually voted on it so many times. It's the education and the understanding that changes over time.
Yes, follow up.
I think your testimony is a perfect example of why we shouldn't have a five-year waiting period. For instance, if it did take four, and I am willing to trust the institutional memory that it took four times to pass, that would have, if your bill had been in effect, or if this proposal had been in effect, that would have been over a 20-year period. And I think the argument that you make about the frequency with which people were forced to confront the question was part of the educational process. If this bill had been in effect, if this constitutional amendment had been in effect prior to the time that we've considered the sales tax, it would be 45 years, you know, with five-year rest periods between each substantially the same tax, sales tax measure. And I don't know that that necessarily protects the public or improves the debate or the discourse. It just adds an unnecessary delay.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I would respectfully disagree with your analysis. If this had been in place, I believe what exactly would have happened is that women would have gotten the right to vote in the like eighth year, which would have been the same time frame that would have happened under this proposal. And that is, they would have had to wait out the two election cycles and then gathered the signatures to get on the ballot again. It would have been probably in that eight-year period. So I'm not sure how you're getting the 40-year period, but I would argue that...
Mr. Chair, I referred to sales tax. We voted sales tax down nine times, and if you simply put a two-cycle rest period between each of those times, you got a 45-year period. So I guess what I'm suggesting, you know, five times nine, what am I making an error in math here? The bottom line is that delaying those substantially, similar initiatives by 5 years, I think it just is an unconscionable abridgment of political speech. Have you run this past the a state attorney general to determine whether, Mr. Chairman, whether or not this would be considered an abridgment of political speech?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, it is a constitutional amendment. So I think that addresses that issue. I think what this really does is force folks who are bringing initiatives to do their homework. Either they have their, they are educating the voters on the issue before they bring it to the ballot so they're successful, or after they fail, they're required to, or they're forced to essentially talk with voters to get the support they need to pass it in the subsequent election cycles. So I would disagree in terms, but you certainly have the right to your perspective.
So when you talk, Mr. Chair, follow up?
Yes.
If you when you talk to the folks that are frustrated with the initiative system, is it the process or is it the outcome they don't like?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, my sense is that folks are frustrated with a couple of things, and that is they're concerned about the fraud and abuse in the initiative system, and I will tell you that I say a lot of things about the work that the Secretary of State does as I travel around the state, and the one sort of comment that I get universal response on is the fraud and abuse in Oregon's initiative system. And the issue that voters raise to me is their frustration with being asked to vote over and over again. For example, on ballot measure 59 or ballot measure 64 that I repeated. I'm not sure by asking voters to repeatedly vote on measures that changes the outcome. And I think we can, if you look at the numbers, at least in the recent last couple of decades, that's the case.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to know where I get to register my complaint about having to vote on the same stupid stuff session after session after session as a legislator. Where do I register my frustration?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, I'd be happy to give you some lessons.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. A couple questions. One, I'll just comment on the sales tax. I think actually if it had been referred 12 times, the result would have been the same. That's just a comment.
It was only 9.
But it was 12.
The 45-year rest period between this would be a great thing.
Because this is a constitutional amendment, and because you've basically put the question forward that this is a similar initiative to what has been voted on, and you're going to have an amendment that you will offer at a later meeting, probably, for the Attorney General to make that judgment.
Mm-hmm.
There are some states that have provisions like this. Is there a body of basically case law that says, to your knowledge, of how they will decide what is similar? Because when we've had these measures before the legislature before, and someone has attempted to describe what is similar, we've always gotten into a little bit of trouble.
Mr. Chair, in response to your question, of the 24 states, I think, that have direct form of democracy, 6 have some kind of timeout provision. The language we based this one on was a statutory language from Wyoming. I'm not familiar with the case law, but we can certainly get that analysis for you.
Okay.
You know, I think part of the problem with sort of this approach in terms of regulation is in a lot of times we're comparing apples to oranges, and Wyoming's timeout is a statutory one. So the case law comparison may not be the most appropriate, but I'll see if I can get constitutional law, case law, and see what's out there and take a look at it and get that information for you.
Any additional questions? Senator Metzger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this forward, Secretary Brown. I actually had a similar, looks almost identical, in 2001, and I do remember working with Ted Rutlinger, Legislative Counsel, about the substantially similar, so I know he has a little case file on that.
Great.
There's ways to get there. But just going to some of the questions posed by Senator Farioli, if this were adopted by the people to say this is what we want, because it is a constitutional amendment, so they would weigh in and make that decision, there's nothing in this proposed amendment to the Constitution that would prevent the legislature, should circumstances dramatically change for whatever reason during the initial timeout period, from taking up an issue that was rejected if, again, there was some material difference between the time that it failed and before the timeout was rejected, that topic could be still dealt with by the elected officials.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I believe the answer to your question is yes. And I think it goes back to Senator Atkinson's question. And I ran the timeline from the citizen from the citizen initiative, not from the legislative referral.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up questions?
Yes.
So I'm getting this right. The citizens would be prevented from putting forward a substantially similar petition, but legislators could refer without a limitation. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, I believe so. I'd have to take a look at the language.
Okay. Mr. Chair, just yes. So you've already got your mind around the idea that you're treating legislators in one way and citizens in a different way.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, I think the legislature, at least in my recent memory, has learned its lessons about repeatedly referring out ballot measures or referrals that have lost, or asking the voters to take a look at them again. Obviously, the history is mixed. Land use, but I do remember two other ballot measures, ballot measure 18, the Barron Cougar measure, and also the assisted suicide measure that the legislature asked the Oregon voters to take a look at. I think the legislature has been fairly self-regulating in sending out repeated referrals that have not been successful.
Well, Mr. Chair, you mentioned land use 7 and 37 had different outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
The assisted suicide initiative or referral initiative and referral had different outcomes also. One passed by 1%, the other one passed by 20%. That might have been a good lesson for the legislature. But I think that there is a learning curve, possibly on some issues, on repeated referral, and I'd point to the Women's Suffrage Initiative as a learning curve that people went through.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, I don't think there's any question that over time that there's a learning curve. I don't think there's any question about that. I think the question is, to what extent are folks bringing these initiatives forward, and to what extent they're doing voter education, and to what extent it's actually changing voters' minds.
And I guess, Mr. Chairman, I'd have to say I think that's more related to the outcome than the process. My perspective.
Yeah. Not to start a debate here with my good friend to the right here, but I do believe there is at least a distinct difference. The initiative process, my understanding, and it's sort of a safety valve for when the legislature is not doing what the public wants it to do, the which for statutory 6%, 8% for constitutional. Obviously, if we're in a representative democracy and a referral is made to the public, the representatives that represent more than 50% of the citizens of this state are actually making the decision to refer it. So I think there is a distinct difference between the two.
Mr. Chairman, you may be right. I've seen referrals made to in order to defeat initiatives.
Yeah. Well, we would get in a long debate here, but I'll leave it at that. Anything that you'd like to close with? That I'm saying?
Likely lifelong, Mr. Chairman.
All good.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thanks for your time. I appreciate your thoughtful consideration. Again, we would like to have an amendment brought forward to have the Attorney General make a decision on the issue of substantially mm-hmm. similar. And I also think the time frame warrants some discussion from the committee. And I'm happy to get the information, Mr. Chair, that you asked about in terms of case law. And Senator Atkinson will get your answer to your question as well.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close public hearing on SGR 31. We have nobody additional signed up. I am going to open a hearing on HB 783. Now, before the committee administrator gives an overview of this bill, I would ask the members of the committee if they would actually show a little bit of restraint. You will see that the relating clause of this bill is relating to campaign finance. There are some issues that members have brought to me, including members of this committee, that they would like this committee to address. We will be discussing those issues at a future date. We're working on them right now. We have several bills that have already been introduced. So I would hope that we would actually keep our discussion today to what is in this bill and not actually what some of the other issues we brought forward about campaign finance, reporting, etc. So with that, if the committee administrator would please give an overview.
Mr. Chairman, I have a process question.
Yes.
Would it be possible to deal with all of the issues in Senate Bill 783 with a vehicle that had a relating clause relating to petition committees?
I do not know the answer to that.
No, Mr. Chairman, I think we should carefully research that issue.
Okay.
Thank you.
But with a relating clause of relating campaign finance, you could do a whole lot of things in this bill.
Yeah, yes, Mr. Chairman. I would think that would be a situation to be devoutly avoided.
Okay.
Your call.
Okay.
Okay. Senate Bill 783 creates a petition committee and requires chief petitioners of initiative, referendum, or recall petitions to create a petition committee comparable to a political committee in order to establish campaign accounts and report contributions and expenditures. You have an amendment in front of you, the -1, submitted by the Secretary of State's office. I've hand engrossed it in your bills. It's section 10 on pages 12 and 13. And we have a fiscal statement stating that the bill would estimated to cost $87,000, and that is to make programming changes to the ORSTAR program.
Okay. Mr. Lindbeck. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed at your leisure.
Good afternoon, Chair Devlin and members of the committee. I am John Lindbeck, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. Seated to my right is Brenda Bays, Deputy Director of the Elections Division. Up here to help rescue me if you ask me questions that I have trouble answering. Senate Bill 783 includes changes to campaign finance reporting laws that are proposed by the Secretary of State's office. There's a set of -1 amendments also supported by the Secretary of State. This bill was originally crafted at the beginning of the fall when the state's financial situation looked better than it does today, and so there are provisions in the bill that include some costs, which are reflected in the fiscal impact statement submitted to the Legislative Fiscal Office. There is also one provision in here dealing with the so-called spot checks of financial transactions reported by committees that is meant to be a conversation starter with the Legislative Assembly rather than a firm proposal from the Secretary of State. I will get into the detail on that in a few moments. What I'd like to go through is a list of subject areas that this bill covers and what it would accomplish. First, it allows political action committees the option of designating an alternate recipient for correspondence from the Secretary of State rather than making the designation a requirement. Currently, that option in statute is limited only to candidate committees, so it brings them up to par with candidate committees. Second, it changes the threshold for filing a statement of organization from $300 to $350. This will relieve candidates who only pay for a filing fee of up to $50, which is for most offices, and a voter's pamphlet statement from the requirement of filing a statement of organization. Currently, all they have to do is buy a voter's pamphlet statement, and it puts them over the threshold. Thirdly, it requires the chief petitioner committees to file campaign finance disclosure reports electronically in the same manner as other political committees. This includes opening a campaign bank account and providing the information to the Division of Elections in the same manner as other political committees. And it allows certificate of limited contributions to be filed by chief petitioner committees. It also requires electronic filing of independent expenditures by entities not already associated with a political committee. These entities now file their reports by paper and are not part of the online searchable database for the public. This will bring the SOS into compliance with ORS 260.057 Section 6, which says that independent expenditures are required to be accessible by the public on the online searchable database. It also amends provisions that require the division, as I indicated earlier, to do spot checks of financial transactions, meaning committees are required to submit backup documentation, such as receipts and copies of checks, to show that a transaction actually happened. Current law says we are to once each quarter ask each state candidate committee to provide backup documents on up to 8 transactions. This bill would change it to twice a year instead of 4 times a year and up to 12 transactions each time. This is the conversation starter I was talking about earlier. We are open to other ideas on making this provision less burdensome to committees and our division. The bill also extends the ban on personal use of campaign funds from just candidate committees to all political committees. And it clarifies definitions of control committees and quote-unquote person. It changes the reference in the statutes from person to quote individual for purposes of campaign finance reporting. It makes it more specific, and the term individual is more concise in scope. It corrects the accidental deletion in 2005 of a requirement that contributions received during a special session of the legislature shall be filed within 2 business days after the date the contribution is received. Currently, because of the accidental deletion, this requirement is only in rule, and we think it would be a good idea to put it back in statute. It gives treasurers and or candidates additional time for hearings on cases related to later insufficient transactions. It would extend the time to request a hearing by a treasurer or a candidate from 30 to 45 days, and the division could grant one 15-day extension. The remaining sections are technical adjustments to numbering sections, etc. The Dash 1 amendments, which are in front of you, would accomplish the following. They would eliminate reporting requirements related to the details of agent expenditures. These expenditures would still have to be reported in the big bottom line number, but this clears up problems that typically occur with committees, particularly with media buys, that are these problems are out of the candidate's control. Often, as we understand it, what a candidate buys is not what you get, and then you have to go back and amend the details on those agent reports. So this would eliminate the requirement that all of those details be reported and keep the requirement that the bottom line number of what is spent on those media buys would still, of course, be required to be reported. It also adjusts, the Dash 1 amendments adjust accounts payable and receivable requirements so that they are reported only if the contribution isn't received by the reporting deadline or the expenditure isn't made by the reporting deadline. And it incorporates chief petitioner committees into those 2 statutory changes. So the sum and substance of this all is that there are several provisions in here, obviously, that make campaign finance reporting less burdensome on political candidates and treasurers. It also, of course, brings chief petitioner committees into the realm of campaign finance reporting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Side conference here.
It's okay.
Sorry. Any questions for Mr. Lindbeck?
Mr. Chair, could you go over again the when someone makes a filing, the Secretary of State, the Election Division comes back and says it's sufficient or insufficient? Can you go over again what this does in that area?
In the terms of when you can request a hearing, is that what you're?
No, once an insufficiency is corrected, you made a reference to that whole issue not before you talked about the hearing in the bill, and I want to make sure I understand it.
Sorry, I'm not recalling exactly what I said on that point.
Okay, I guess my question is, right now, if you declare an insufficiency and then the treasurer or the candidate corrects it, we never hear back whether we did it right. And I'm just wondering if... Senator Richard?
Yeah, Mr. Lindbeck, I understand your question. Do you want me to interpret?
Okay, you interpret.
Yes. Okay. You make a transaction. You get the report back says you've made the transaction. Then a few days later, you get a report back that says the transactions are fine, there's no problems. Or you get a report back that says there is an insufficiency. There's an insufficiency. You correct the insufficiency, but you never get another report back that says that you're satisfied with the correction of the insufficiency. That's the issue, right? You never know if you've actually corrected it to the satisfaction of the Elections Division of the Secretary of State.
Okay. Further translation, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
What you do get is 2.5 years later, you get somebody else raking it up and saying, look, you never did answer this complaint, and it's still on the books. Now you have 10 days more, and blah, blah, blah.
Okay. But that's the basic question is, once they do correct something now that has been identified, you don't hear back that the correction is adequate.
And I guess my question is, Mr. Chairman, is why on earth don't you hear back? If something, either you correct it correctly or you've still missed the mark, how come you never hear back whether it is... It's back in sufficiency, back in sufficient status?
Well... First of all, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, this bill does not go into that process. We're happy to discuss this issue with you in great detail and provide more reporting back to committees if that's what the legislature would like. I'm not sure exactly what the answer to your question is, other than there's a presumption that if you corrected it, we assume that the information... and that the correction is correct. Follow me? Does that make sense?
So Mr. Chairman, I guess where I'm getting at with this is I would think it would be a very positive addition to the subject matter of this bill with the very big relating clause to put a provision in there where a candidate has the comfort of knowing that they have done it right. And that someone's not going to come back after them 3 years later saying, you messed this up. So.
Okay. Any additional questions? Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lindbeck, back to your point about the starter conversation that you have in the bill in terms of the spot checks and what Senator Ferry always said about, you know, the 2.5 year you get a spot check follow-up, and I'm familiar with that and as well. You also talked about, you know, wanting to do something that, you know, help take away some of the burden of some of these things that have not proved to be very problematic, with the assumption that you want to spend that time on things you think are more problematic. Can you give me, in the sense of the committee, just some sense in terms of the time element that has been taken? I mean, obviously, if it's 2.5 years later, you get a comment from the spot check. Obviously, there's a lot of paperwork that's stacking up. In terms of how burdensome that has been of just following each of those for everybody all the time.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, it has been very burdensome. We have 15 people in the Division of Elections that don't, and we do a lot of things, including campaign finance. The way the Elections Division has been managed long before I got there is everybody is trained to do everything, and at various times in the election cycle, people are pulled away to work on one thing, such as the initiative process when we're when we're going through the signature verification process. That means that work on everything else stops. And we have other examples of that. And so we take care of these things when we get the time to do that. If you wandered into our division during an election year, our people are on the phone all day long. And so checking and rechecking all the information submitted on the spot checks, for example, has fallen down on the priority list, and that has to wait until the phones stop ringing so people can actually look at this stuff and concentrate on it. So thus, you get sometime later a second request to submit that information if it was deemed that the information that was originally submitted by a committee was not sufficient to meet the request. And that's why some of these things do take some time. So the spot checks has been a big workload for us, and one of those things that gets moved down the list while people answer the phone and help people with complying with campaign disclosure in the heat of the election year. And so we would appreciate if people are still interested in doing spot checks, something that is less burdensome on us as well as less burdensome on the committees. I will tell you that we have had, since this law was passed in 2005, we have had one newspaper reporter come in and look at the backup documentation, and no other members of the public have ever looked at it. I'm not getting the impression that there is a huge demand for this information. But it was obviously the state's largest newspaper that was interested and has continued to come in and review the information that's submitted by the committees. So, just in my personal view, I can't say that we have a huge demand, and it's a lot of work on both sides.
Can I follow up to that, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Well, thank you for that, Mr. Lindbeck, because I can imagine it is, and I would venture to guess that the one person that has come in and looked at it has found it hasn't been very entertaining information to see. And I think whether it's the language that we have here or whatever, I think would be very, very appropriate, Mr. Chair, to help free up a department that is continually restrained by extensive paperwork. And the fact of the matter is that, as we all know, this was created at a very unfortunate situation that someone was put in because they went beyond what I have, and I believe any of you have known of any public official to actually defraud the system, you know, and as a result of that, we put a very big burden on the Secretary of State's office for what I believe is a 100% or as close to that you can public service people trying to meet all these responsibilities, but the chance of seeing another example like that are rare. And I would suggest that as we talk about that particular issue, we may look at what we do with the Secretary of State, having looked at some of these things pretty extensively and the work that does take for them to do this, is how we handle the audits division. And that you continue to do these random audits and continue to do spot checks, knowing that in any period cycle of time, your account is going to get a spot check. You don't know when it's going to be, but it's going to happen during a period of time, just like we do with the Secretary of State's Audits Division, but doesn't subject every three months to basically an audit of everybody who is a public servant. And I think that has been a huge burden on the Secretary of State, and it does provide, obviously, angst for other people who, like you say, 2.5 years later say, well, show me that check again. And, you know, people like Bank of America don't provide checks anymore. They're only available online for 6 months. And you actually have to write and order them after that, and they may not be on the same timeline as the Secretary of State. So I think that's, and yet at the end of the day, the information is there and is conveyed. So I think that would be a proper way to look at how we might redirect some of those resources, but by continuing to have that spot check audit function, but in a way that doesn't, burden for something that hasn't proven to be a real issue.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Burdick, and then if there's no other questions, we'll go on to the next bill.
Okay. Mr. Chair, thank you. Along those same lines in terms of workload, I think the language says up to 8 and you're proposing up to 12. Well, every time my campaign has gotten one, it's been the full 8, and it really probably hasn't been nearly the problem for us that it's been for you having so many to deal with. But have you thought about, do you do the maximum amount as a matter of course? Would it be helpful to do fewer for some of them? Or
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, yes, we could look at that, just doing fewer for each committee. The more transactions you have as a committee, the greater the likelihood that you'll be asked for the full 8. There are some committees that have very few transactions, and so they don't get asked for as many. We're open to anything and would appreciate a conversation and legislative guidance on this because we think it's something that needs changing.
Thank you.
Okay. Any additional questions? This is just an initial hearing on this bill, so there'll be another opportunity for hearings. So I'll close the hearing. Open hearing on SB 577. Could the committee administrator give a brief overview?
Senate Bill 577 provides that any case challenging the ethics laws passed in Senate Bill 10 in 2007 shall be certified directly to the Oregon Supreme Court for expedited review.
Okay. Senator Metzger, would you like to address the committee first as soon as I can get...
They're real excited about this. Why don't we just take a little time out until they come back?
Okay.
There's only two of us here, and we're not a quorum.
Well, we don't need a quorum for
here. Hearing. Senator Farrell.
Senator Metzger, we'll wait until we get a couple people back here. Mr. DiLorenzo, if you'd come forward also, I'll go to you next. We got a quorum now. Senator Metzger, if you'd like to just give a brief overview.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I introduced this bill. There's been a lot of talk about the... gift limitations, et cetera, and it's incumbent on this body to provide the type of statutory law to meet the goals of the public. And the reality is that this issue has, in a number of forms, been presented to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has found it unconstitutional. And there is certainly a challenge to that now. That's in the circuit court. It will go to the Court of Appeals, and it will go to the Supreme Court, but because of the court docket, it's likely to be 4 or 5 years before we have that verdict, at which point, if it is found to be unconstitutional, it will be incumbent on this body to look at the court language and see how else we can meet the goals of the public under the Constitution. And since the constitutional issue, to many people, believes is very clear, I think it's in the best interest of the public that we get this issue to the Supreme Court as quickly as possible for their guidance on how we might deal with this issue. I might remind the committee that we did a similar thing in 2003, and we did reform of the public employee retirement system, and realizing there are going to be some significant constitutional questions, that we advance that after passage directly to review by the U.S. Supreme Court so that the legislature would have an opportunity to deal with those consequences. And as you might remember, a couple of the provisions were indeed, as we thought, found unconstitutional, and then the legislature acted accordingly based on the guidance of the Supreme Court. And since this issue is so important and it's so much the discussion, part of the discussion we all have, I think it's in the best interest of the public to get the ultimate decision as soon as possible so that we may see where we go on the next iteration. And that's the purpose of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I will go to Mr. DiLorenzo next, and then we'll go to questions. Mr. DiLorenzo, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo, and I'm an attorney with the law firm of Davis Wright Germain, and am here in support of Senate Bill 577. I am also legal counsel to the plaintiffs in Vannata versus Oregon Government Ethics Commission. My client is the Center to Protect Free Speech. That is the very same organization that led the legal challenge to Measures 6 and 9, which were adopted in 1994, and which had imposed significant restrictions on campaign contributions. In that case, the Oregon Supreme Court took the position that campaign contributions are speech and that any laws limiting contributions offend Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, which protects the right to speak freely on any matter whatever. Our case against the lobby limits in Senate Bill 10 was commenced shortly before Senate Bill 10 went into effect. And I can review some of our positions, and what I'd like to do, because the chair asked for a briefing for the committee, is just basically touch on the facts and then the two basic approaches we are taking on the appeal and why Senate Bill 577 will greatly expedite the consideration of the appeal. The facts in the case are unchallenged. Mr. Van Atta, who is here today, is a lobbyist registered on behalf of clients, including small woodland owners. He has legislative interests, which are defined as economic interests, distinct from that of the general public, in a variety of proposals before the legislature. Senate Bill 10 prevents him from engaging in speech, including paying for travel for legislators to witness small woodland operations on their own so they can better understand the impacts of various legislative proposals. I have provided you a handout, and on the second page of the handout I have a flowchart of basically what position we took in the litigation. Our first claim is that the lobby limits, expenditure limits, violate Article 1, Section 8 directly. The first thing the court was asked to decide, the circuit court, was do the lobbying expenditures restricted by Senate Bill 10 constitute expression? We took the position that the lobby expenditures were in fact speech, just like campaign contributions are speech. The state took the position that they were not speech, that they were just ancillary to being able to speak. The circuit court found in our favor on that point and cited the first Van Atta case and said, yes, these expenditures are in fact so inextricably tied with speech that they are in fact part of speech. The next question then was, if they were speech, how would they be analyzed? The court initially took the position that because Senate Bill 10 does not target any specific harm and just regulates the speech, is what is called a Category 1 law, which means it's unconstitutional unless there is some historic exception that applies. In other words, was this type of speech regulated in 1859? Does the incompatibility exception apply? And what the court did was, for the first time ever, found that it is incompatible with the office of a legislator to accept lobby expenditures in excess of $50. Now, this finding was made notwithstanding the fact that in Van Atta versus Kiesling, the Oregon Supreme Court found that accepting campaign contributions was not only not incompatible with the role of the legislator, but was part and parcel of that role because legislators, unlike judges, are not supposed to be objective. You are supposed to come here with an agenda. You are supposed to rally people who are like-minded to support you, and there is absolutely nothing in the Constitution that says you're supposed to be fair. You're supposed to be fierce advocates of your position and zealous representatives of your constituencies. So that was a major departure, we felt, from the established case law. After the court found that the incompatibility exception applied, the circuit court denied our petition for an injunction. We then came back with a different approach, and we said, all right, fine, if assuming for the sake of argument that this is speech and that the incompatibility exception applies, Senate Bill 10 discriminates among speakers because it only applies if the speaker has a legislative or administrative interest, which, as you well know, is a term of art, which means an economic interest distinct from that of the general public. So if I am representing George Soros, who, for example, who decides that he wants to advocate some legislation that will completely shut off the commercial fishing industry, because in his mind, maybe the best way to save endangered salmon is to not kill them to begin with. Where's his economic interest? He has none. He is allowed to use every single tool that would be prohibited to those in the commercial fishing industry who would be defending their position before you, because they do have an economic interest in the defeat of that legislation. So it was our position that because Article 1, Section 8, and also the First Amendment, will not tolerate discrimination among speakers, that the law should also fall. The Circuit Court, in a later hearing, sort of, in our view, reversed its position somewhat and said, this isn't really a Category 1 law. It's a Category 2 law. This is merely a time, place, and manner restriction. You know, we argued that, well, it's no time, no place, no how. There can't be any expenditures in excess of $50. But that was the end of that. And so that took quite some time to litigate. The points are being opposed very zealously by the Attorney General's office. We filed our brief as soon as we could, which was on March 27th of this year. And so the case has been going on for quite some time, but sometimes litigation proceeds at a glacial rate. The state's brief is due May 15. We anticipate the Department of Justice will ask for numerous extensions. What Bill 577 does is allow us to basically bypass the Court of Appeals and to, upon motion, transfer the whole case, including the briefs that have been filed, to the Supreme Court. It also directs the Supreme Court to expedite review, placing this case ahead of its civil docket, so that it can get to the matter as soon as possible. Because this case cannot be settled, because it will ultimately end up in the Supreme Court anyway, we believe passage of the bill will save all of the parties, including the Attorney General's office, significant time, expense, possibly years worth of time, and will conserve judicial resources and expense. I want to thank Senator Metzger for taking the time to look into this matter and introducing the bill and supporting it, and I am available to answer any questions that you may have concerning either the case or the bill.
Any questions for Senator Metzger or Mr. DiLorenzo?
I just have one question.
Yes.
Just based on your experience, Mr. DiLorenzo, what would be the earliest expectation that the court might take this up should this bill become law?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I believe that because there's an emergency clause on the bill, as soon as the bill is passed, we would likely file our motion in the Court of Appeals. The Senate Bill 577 would require the Court of Appeals to then certify the case to the Supreme Court, and it would require the Supreme Court to accept the case. That would probably take about 30 days. The Supreme Court would then be directed to expedite consideration of the case. The court would first check to see how many briefs have been filed. Ours certainly will have been filed. If the Department of Justice hasn't filed the brief yet, there would probably be a conference call to schedule filings of briefs. I would hope that if the bill passed, this matter could end up on the docket for the Supreme Court for oral argument, maybe by July, and we could possibly know by November or so if the bill passed. Otherwise, we're looking at least two and a half years before we have final resolution through the Oregon Supreme Court.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
What kind of status? We've passed a bill out of this committee and across the Senate floor making some changes in the gift requirement and other requirements of Senate Bill 10. What would be the status of those changes if the court ruled one way or the other?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, what you have, as far as I can tell, what you have done in Senate Bill 30 that impacts our case, not significantly, is you have eliminated the total prohibition on entertainment and you have included it in the $50 limit. Everything else you've done really doesn't pertain to the case because you have eliminated the bad public policy that was initially in Senate Bill 10 that had nothing to do with speech by refining what a legislative or administrative interest is. So, for instance, the ridiculous circumstances in which two co-workers in the same agency cannot buy a gift for one another because they happen to have a legislative or administrative interest in the agency they work for. You've eliminated circumstances like that. None of that is core political speech that this case concerns, and so the issues will still be present in the case capable of resolution by the court, notwithstanding whether Senate Bill 30 passes or not.
But, Mr. Chair, if you prevailed in the in your case with the gift revisions, would they be thrown out of Measure 30, the ones we adopted in Measure 30?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, if we are successful in the case, there would be no gift limit, not just not $50, not $100, there would be no gift limit at all. At that point, the legislature would be faced with a number of options. One option might be a constitutional amendment that could be referred to do something. The other one would be something I've been advocating for a long, long time, which is real-time reporting of lobby expenditures. I served on the Oregon Law Commission. I'm still a member of the commission. And when we were writing our version of Senate Bill 10, we determined that for less than $100,000, for maybe $100,000 plus, the Secretary of State's computer system could be utilized to provide assistance to the Ethics Commission to have real-time reporting of lobby expenditures. When I used to make lobby expenditures, I would seek reimbursement from my firm, and those expenditures would be appropriately billed. If I could seek reimbursement from my firm, there's no reason why I couldn't, with the addition of a few keystrokes, report the expenditure on a real-time basis to the Secretary of State's office or to the Commission. And so that would be another option. My own personal belief is that, notwithstanding the problems we have had in the past regarding lobby expenditures, true justice has occurred when those circumstances have come to light, and it's in the reporting that justice is served and the problems are resolved. Normally, it's not in the penalty phase by the Ethics Commission. It's when these things come to light. And my solution is to cast light on the whole subject area. So that would be something that the legislature could also do if we prevailed in the case.
Thank you. Follow-up question. What sort of a situation we would be in if this went to the Court of Appeals and you prevailed in the Court of Appeals and the Attorney General filed an appeal with the Supreme Court? What is your reading in terms of would the law on the books, well, it would depend how the court did this, but we could be in a scenario in which you had prevailed. There's still a pending appeal to the Supreme Court. The Attorney General is appealing, but the Attorney General simultaneously is saying not to enforce the existing law.
Mr. Chairman, what would happen if we prevailed in the Court of Appeals is that there would not be a mandate issued or an appellate judgment issued from the Court of Appeals during the period of time that the Attorney General would have to file a petition for cert to the, yeah, or petition for review rather, to the Oregon Supreme Court. If the Oregon Supreme Court took the case, there would not be an appellate judgment until such time as the Supreme Court resolved it. If the Supreme Court refused to accept the case, then an appellate judgment would issue, and at that point then we would have to maybe remand back to the circuit court to fine-tune, or it all depends on what the opinion would say.
Okay. Any additional questions? Well, thank you for coming today.
Thank you very much.
Really thank you for Mr. Van Atta coming today. I Mr. Van Out is often in the building these days, but it's usually on fish-related issues. And I'm going to ask the Senate President that no fish-related issues come to rules. We have one bill left on the agenda. I will close the public hearing on SB 577. Open a public hearing on SB 773. Will the committee administrator give a brief overview?
Senate Bill 773 changes requirements for who can serve as trustee for a public official's legal defense trust fund.
Okay. Senator Burdick, you're the only one signed up to testify unless there's someone else in the audience. You have the floor either here or if you want to go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just stay here. This actually came out. I actually had a legal trust. I was, to my knowledge, I was the first person in Oregon to have a legal trust as established under Senate Bill 10. Before Senate Bill 10, legal expenses for campaign issues, campaign complaints through the Secretary of State's office could be paid for from your campaign funds. And the particular type of violation I was defending was one of those ones in Senate Bill 10 where you were not allowed to use campaign funds. And so there was a provision put in Senate Bill 10 to allow a legal trust to be formed. But the requirements for the legal trust were, when you actually have to implement them, were very, very onerous, and to my way of looking at it, they didn't accomplish. They involved a lot of work and a lot of expense without any good policy outcome at the end. And basically what the legal trust provision required is that a candidate forming a legal trust would have to appoint a trustee. And the trustee would have to do all the solicitation of money for the legal trust. And of course, it would be a separate fund from any campaign fund. The trustee would have to do all the solicitation, all of the reporting, and the reporting requirements were stringent, just like they are with regular campaigns. But if the trustee did something wrong, then the person liable for the violation was the candidate, even though the candidate had absolutely nothing to do and legally could have nothing to do with how the trust was administered or funded. So it, to my way of thinking, I had no choice but to ask a person to be my trustee who was, in fact, a lawyer, not the same lawyer that I had defending me in my Secretary of State issue. But by the time I finished, doing the trust and setting up the trust, there was a document, you know, half an inch thick to form the trust, and it added, and the lawyer that I had for the proceeding itself actually did the documentation for the trust, because a lawyer had to do it because the requirements were so rigorous. So basically, it added probably another 25% to 30% to my legal costs to just have to do it through the trust itself. And my trustee did most of the work pro bono. I did manage to pay him a little bit and appreciate very much what he did, and he did everything right, so there was no complaint against me. So it had a happy ending in terms of, you know, getting the job done that the trust was designed for, but it was a tremendous cost. And so as I looked at the requirement in the in Senate Bill 10, to me the policy value of having a separate legal trust is the value of having a separate fund so that people who contribute to it know that they're contributing to legal expenses and not toward campaign expenses. So from a policy standpoint, I think we're on very solid ground when we have a legal issue that, you know, you can tell your contributors these funds are going to be used for legal purposes and legal purposes only. Whereas under the old law, where you could use campaign funds, people would think they were contributing to a campaign, and then they would have money used for legal expenses. So I think the value in the requirement is having a separate fund. but the detriment of it is there were unnecessary complications. So what Senate Bill 773 does is it just requires that a separate fund be set up, but it keeps the candidate in charge and responsible and accountable for how the fund is administered, and it also puts the candidate in charge of soliciting funds for the legal trust. I haven't gotten a legislative council opinion on this, but to tell, based on case law that we have in Oregon, attorney general opinions and court opinions, we have the strongest free speech provision in the country, and to tell a candidate they cannot exercise their power of speech to solicit a contribution is raises a red flag in terms of constitutionality. So Senate Bill 773 would retain the value of the legal trust provision so that there would be transparency, so contributors would know they were contributing toward a candidate's legal expenses, but it would take out all the unnecessary requirements and a possibly unconstitutional restriction on speech.
Okay. Any questions for Senator Burdick? Okay. Well, we'll close the public hearing and come back to some of these bills in a week or two. Committee members, we have a hearing or a meeting scheduled. I believe they're trying to look for a time that will work Friday morning. I don't believe it'll be 10. I think the time they're looking at is 10:30. So we'll have that meeting, and then we will not have a meeting next Tuesday, but we'll have a meeting the following Friday, or that Friday, the Friday of next week. So with that, we're adjourned. I see your point on...